Have you tried using ChatGPT to research and pick stocks? This is something I've tried a few times, and I wanted to see if others have had any success with ChatGPT as their AI research assistant. I found someone who has developed a custom ChatGPT to research and pick stocks. Matt Volodarsky is my guest today. Matt has a very unique background and set of skills, and he is a successful investor who has developed the Wealthy Owl investment portfolio and one of the best methodologies I have seen to find and evaluate multi-bagger stocks that can be big winners in our portfolio. Today, I will talk about how he uses ChatGPT to research stocks, how you can do the same, and Matt walks us through the Wealthy Owl methodology for finding multi-baggers. I learned a lot talking to Matt. I'm sure you will do too.
I built this custom GPT that basically takes the methodology that we'll be talking about today for selecting technology stocks, and it evaluates any stock that you want it to evaluate just by entering the name of the stock into this GPT, and it'll give you an assessment as a starting point. It definitely is still early days of some of this tech, so some kinks to be worked out, but I think it offers some pretty good insights for people who are looking to get a snapshot assessment of interesting stocks they might be looking at. Well, the fun thing about custom GPTs is anyone can build these. They're very accessible. You just essentially write some instructions in plain English, and that tells GPT what to do when interacting with the user. So I don't have any programming skills myself, and so I thought this would be a perfect way of getting more of my methodology out to folks who are interested in applying it to stocks of interest. And so definitely I've fed it the process, the sort of questions to ask across the various criteria I use, and it uses a scoring system that I inputted. But in terms of the data itself, it's using the public internet as one of its main sources. I have uploaded some documents to sort of the knowledge base that the custom GPT uses, but it's really the combination of those two sources.
That's fantastic. So, for example, if you want to assess the quality of management, of leadership of the company, what did you say to ChatGPT to evaluate? Can you tell us, if you could share, what kind of prompt or what kind of instructions you gave to ChatGPT so that it can assess the quality of leadership?
Leadership is a great one to start with. I definitely fed it some key questions to ask and directed it to look for certain attributes, things like whether or not the company is founder-led. That's an important criterion I look for in stocks. Obviously, not all stocks have a founder at the top, but that's definitely something I sort of assign bonus points for. I had it look for whether or not technical leadership is in place and in the right positions, whether or not the company and its leadership took a long-term vision, willing to sacrifice in the short term for long-term investment and growth. So those are some of the main attributes, which I, again, fed into the system. And if you want to have this custom GPT assess the leadership of whatever stock you're interested in, then you can ask it in plain language. That's the beauty of ChatGPT, is we can just use natural language and it'll answer back. I always advise people when they're just starting out with it to go for the macro view and ask for an assessment of the entire company. It will run through the six criterion that I use and we're going to talk about for evaluating stocks. And then you can drill into other areas.
That's perfect. So when you explain to it, evaluate the quality of management or evaluate whether the original founders are still the CEO or the president or is still involved in the company in some yeah. way or form, you stop there and GPT basically evaluate that and gathers data and identify that, or do you direct it to some sort of a database that already knows who are founder-led companies?
Yeah, I wish I was able to connect it to that database, but I haven't gotten there yet. So this is why I do put some caveats that, you know, it's not perfect. But to answer your question more directly, it looks to the public internet to find answers to that question. So there's definitely some times where, you know, it might get it wrong. That's the nature of where we are with this generative AI technology today. And lots of improvements are coming to help minimize or eliminate some of those hallucinations, as they refer to them. So for most of the criteria and most of the questions I direct it to answer, it's just using the public internet. For some of the more data specific areas of my evaluation methodology, I direct it to specific finance sites like Yahoo Finance or Google Finance to make sure it's accessing the most current and reliable information for that.
It's good that it doesn't necessarily have access to special databases because it replicates what a retail investor would go through, because most of the retail investors, maybe they have subscription to StockCard or maybe they have subscriptions to other platforms, you know, or just use publicly available information, but they don't necessarily have access to a database of data such as founder-led companies or things like that. Or if they even have access to it, they may not have the time and energy even to go on every time look at all that information. So it ends up being a public search.
I view it kind of as a time saver to get a quick snapshot assessment and give you a qualitative, or in this case, a quantitative score to see if it's worth investigating further. So I use it primarily as a screener at this stage. I definitely would not recommend this as a tool to make a final investment decision, but it's a good way to screen companies initially to assess whether or not it's worth doing some further due diligence. In fact, if your viewers are interested, I am looking to redeploy some capital in my model portfolio that's up on StockCard. And so feel free to send me some companies that you're interested in, and I'll run them through my custom GPT to see which ones score the highest, and then even do a deep dive myself, doing my more in-depth research and due diligence to give a proper assessment.
That is awesome. I'm sure some of our community members are going to pick you up on that offer. And how long does it take to run the model? Usually ChatGPT is very fast in coming up with the data, but I'm sure you ask, is it like a one-time click that you just say, run this, and it already goes through all the steps that you defined previously, or do you interact with the tool and keep asking questions?
Yeah, you definitely can interact, but I do recommend starting to get the overall assessment across the six criteria. So the prompt I use is simply, can you do an analysis of this stock? And then it will run through the six criteria, assign a score for each of them, and give you some bullet points that explain the rationale for the score and some examples.
So we'll make sure we put a link in the show notes and in the email that goes to our users. So if anybody who has a premium subscription to ChatGPT OpenAI can use it and test it. And if they don't have access to it, they can send you an email. And maybe at the end, we give your contact information or a way for people to connect with you on Twitter, x.com. But we've been talking about your portfolio and we've been talking about your framework. And this is something I'm super excited to talk about. First of all, because your portfolio and the StockCard, the Wealthy Owl portfolio, gross portfolio, I'm looking at it on my phone, has 48%, almost 49% weighted average gain of all your decisions in the portfolio. And it is overperforming the S&P 500 on average by 34%. And there are 27 stocks in this portfolio, and 14 of them, so almost half, are overperforming the S&P 500. And the portfolio was created in 2021. So it is almost a three-year portfolio, or 2 years and a half portfolio. It is fantastic return. It's exciting to see this portfolio is performing so well. And I can only see two reasons behind it. One is the framework and methodology you're using. It's working very well. And second, you as an investor, you were a good investor. You just don't panic when the stocks in the portfolio go down, or you just don't sell if something just jump up if you don't see a reason. So let me stop speculating and ask you, first of all, what is your reaction to the return of the portfolio? Was this expected? And how do you, just give us a general sense of how do you manage this specific portfolio that you have on StockCard? And then we will get to the methodology right after.
You know, whether or not I expected it, I think I feel good about the framework. It took many, many years to develop, and lots of mistakes and hard lessons along the way, which hopefully, you know, will shortcut the process a bit for your community where they don't have to make the same mistake I did. And so, yeah, I feel good about the methodology and the process. And so there is a level of trust in that process that in time it will be rewarded. I couldn't have predicted that with the lows that we were hitting only a couple of years ago, that it would only be 2 years later that I would be beating the S&P. With the trust in the process, I felt good about getting there in time. I'm definitely a long-term investor. I do my due diligence. I form a thesis on a stock that I'm investing in. I revisit that thesis on a regular basis, on a quarterly basis. If anything has changed in that thesis, then I'll make adjustments. But if the stock drops in price, like most of my tech holdings did, you know, a couple of years ago when the market was not performing well, I just go back to that thesis. If I feel like it's intact, I will hold and have confidence in the process that I went through. And if I need to drop some companies that have changed direction or not delivering on that thesis, then I'll do that as well. I don't have issue dropping names and being wrong, but I hope and trust that that is the exception and not the rule.
What differentiates a good investor from an average investor is the presence of some sort of a well-thought process that is a living process. To your point, it's never, you create a process and then you go make some investment decisions and some of them work and some of them don't work. What I really liked about what you were saying a few seconds ago is that this process for you is also a living process. You look back and reflect on your decisions and then keep enhancing the portfolio, the process behind the portfolio. And that's what you've been doing over the years. That's why now this is the outcome of that iterative process of you coming up with good ideas and then reflecting back on the bad ideas and trying to improve your process, which is such an important approach to investing. So let's jump into the process. The process, I was looking at your website, you call it a framework to find multi-baggers. That itself by itself is very exciting. So tell me and tell our audience, what was the thought process behind finding multi-baggers? And then let's just jump into the overall framework. What's in it?
Over the years, have built this disposition. It didn't come naturally, but a disposition to be comfortable holding for the long term for what I believe will be outsized gains. And that's necessary. There's no shortcut. Right? These trends that I'm often investing in through specific companies take time to play out. And I felt very comfortable that I would be able to do that with the process I go through. And so I felt like I should pursue that. Not my entire portfolio. I definitely invest in other types of stocks, not just tech, which the framework that we're going to be talking about today is very tuned and focused on technology stocks. But for a portion of my portfolio, I think to generate wealth-altering returns over the long run, over 10-plus years, you need to take some big swings. And that's what a multi-bagger is. The technical definition, I suppose, is based on, you know, the percentage gains. So a single multi-bagger would be equivalent to a 100% gain, a doubling of the stock, and it goes up from there. Obviously, many investors have this goal of getting to a 10-bagger status. I think there was even a book written about 100-baggers. So it's a very sexy ideal to strive for in selecting stocks with the massive gains that come with it. But I think it's more about betting on these secular trends, these mega trends, which play out over, in some cases, a decade. That's actually where the process starts of the 6 criteria. That's the first characteristic that I look for in companies that I invest in to achieve this multi-bagger level of gains. And I call that characteristic riding a mega trend that has arrived. Because when you're looking for the next tech multi-bagger stock, tailwinds really do matter. And there's no greater tailwind for technology stocks than a mega trend. And when I say megatrend, what I'm really referring to is this major transformative force that impacts the economy, the business world, society, and delivers long-term value. You know, think about on the order of cars, the internet, demographic changes. And in today's world, this is very much being the biggest transformative force is generative AI, I believe, and many others do. And so that's what I mean by a mega trend.
Have you done some studies and then every year you go back to it? Like, what are those, generative AI being one, other ones? So, and how do you identify those mega trends?
Yeah, I think it's just reading a lot. Twitter is a great source. There's different analysts that I think publish a lot of good insight about these mega trends, big ideas, whatever you want to call them. So that's sort of the input mechanism for ones that I'm particularly interested in. I'll go really deep on, you know, in some cases, if there's been some good books recently that have been published about it. I'll take the time to go deep to really determine what are the mega trends that I want to invest in, because we can lose sight of or mistake what is really a fad from a mega trend that is this massive transformative force that's going to take, you know, 5-10 years to fully play out. So there are some stringent criteria that I would really recommend when assessing the mega trend and determining if it is investment worthy, right? Like, how do we separate the mega trends from the fads? Because there's all sorts of cautionary tales. I don't know if you remember the Segway, that personal mobility device that was launched in the early 2000s, I think, to much fanfare. You know, people were talking about how this was going to be as impactful as the PC. Well, today, if you look around, it seems like only mall cops or tour groups are using these. So the market turned out to be a lot smaller, and this was more of a fad than a mega trend. And so, yeah. You know, the things that I really screen for, and it starts off with a mindset of being skeptical of what you're reading. I've done some research on different ways or different methodologies for separating mega trends from fads. I like the Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies. They've got a methodology where they talk about how true mega trends have this broad scope, a long time horizon, like 10 plus years, and the potential for significant shifts in these macro areas like economics, like technology or society. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, be really skeptical and do the diligence to separate trends from fads, but also consider that the timing sometimes isn't right, right? It can take time for these technologies to really develop, to get to a point where they're mature enough to be adopted at a mainstream level. It could be that not all the necessary infrastructure is in place, or the business model may not be fully optimized. Like, think about music moving to streaming, how many iterations of the business model there were before that kind of got perfected by Apple and Spotify. Look at whether or not all the necessary technology pieces are in place, and whether or not the timing is right for investing in that megatrend for mainstream adoption.
So it's basically something differentiating fad from our actual megatrend, and second one is readiness. So something like, and I don't know what your point of view is on blockchain and things like that. It could have been, yes, it could be very transformative, but maybe the technology is not still ready because it's not fast. You can't transact in speed. So there's probably another decade of improvements on that infrastructure for the technology to be ready. But, or it could be that your point of view is that that's a total fad and it's not something that you want to bet on.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I think you can do some initial screening to separate the fad from the true trend that's going to have these transformative impacts on the economy, the society at a larger sort of context. I'm not super deep on blockchain, I got to be honest. I think a good example to assess whether or not the timing is right is, you know, if you go back to the mid-90s, the explosion of the internet, there was a lot of excitement. There was this promise of information at your fingertips, right? But that was hard to realize when you consider that most people at the time spent large portions of their day and evenings away from their desktop computers. And so it really took the arrival of smartphones in the early 2000s to kick off that next wave of the adoption of the internet. And once that happened, then we started seeing these whole new companies that we could have never imagined, the Airbnbs, the Ubers, really take off when this level of maturity in the tech was in place.
That makes a lot of sense. And you kind of answered one of my questions I was going to ask you. Looking at your portfolio, you brought up, we're giving away one name, which is Airbnb, in that portfolio. Yep. And it's basically based on that megatrend that you were just talking about, the adoption of mobile technology and accessibility across all devices and ease of accessibility to information across all devices that enables a company like Airbnb to be so successful and generate so much free cash flow and so much revenue compared to old school hotel and accommodation companies.
Yeah. The next one is market opportunity. But I think with what you just mentioned, it's a good opportunity to set some further context here that I've really tuned this to what I think it takes for technology companies to win. Certainly some of these are applicable to any company. But as we go through these, I think you'll find some of them are pretty specific to what it takes to succeed for a technology company. But having said that, returning to number two of the criteria, this process is nothing if not thorough. But the second is market opportunity, right? We're talking about what's the overall revenue size of the market opportunity that the company that you're looking at is competing in. And the key to finding tech companies that have a long runway of growth is to find ones that participate in a big enough market of buyers that can be reached in a scalable manner. I think it's really important as investors to actually have a point of view on the estimates that are out there on a company's TAM. Obviously, the CEO is going to be very enthusiastic. They may embellish. I'm not accusing anyone of that individually, but we've all seen it before. We're going to conquer this entire industry. And I think it's important to be critical of that, to have a point of view on the TAM that's being estimated. Question the assumptions. I'm not suggesting that you pull out an Excel spreadsheet and get to a precision level analysis of the TAM yourself. But don't just take the CEO's word for it. So overestimation, interestingly, is not the only risk I see here in not properly assessing the market opportunity. Sometimes there's some underestimation, and we can miss massive opportunities for that reason. There's a number of reasons for why certain markets get underestimated. One of them is the notion of a bad product fallacy, which is when people dismiss a new tech because it doesn't meet their personal use cases today. But there also can be some initial limitations on these new technologies. A great example, if you'll allow me to spend a moment on just one example, is back in the 80s when AT&T missed out on the early mover advantage in the cell phone market because they grossly underestimated how many phones, cell phones there would be in the marketplace. It wasn't just their fault. They did hire a consultant to estimate the size of the cell phone industry by the year 2000 was what they wanted to project forward to assess whether or not this was a market worth entering. They forecasted 900,000 cell phones to be in use by the year 2000. They were off a little bit, 99% to be exact. It turned out that by 2000, the global cell phone market had grown to 738 million people around the world that owned a cell phone. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason for the under forecast was the consultants got mired in the problems with cell phones at the time. This was back in the 80s, so they were too heavy, the batteries ran out quickly, there was poor coverage, and they were insanely expensive. They didn't have the imagination that, hey, this technology would continue to miniaturize, economies of scale would kick in to bring down the cost, network technology would improve. And so they missed the boat, and they had to play catch up. And we can do that as individual investors if we dismiss the potential for some markets. So yeah, it's kind of a yin and yang. Don't overestimate, but don't underestimate either.
Yeah. And it's very hard because obviously if you look at back, a lot of investors want to look at the facts, right? And then when you get the facts, it's always backward looking because you get the fact from historical data. And in case of your mobile example, is that because they probably looked at how many people are using it now, and then they try to forecast it based on some sort of a forecasting methodology and growth, and they just realize it's not going to go anywhere. Yeah. But in the case of investing in massive, in your framework, because you're talking about the mega trends that are going to change the way society lives, you can't be backward looking. You have to be forward looking, and you have to look at, the cycles of technology. It's going to be lower cost. It's going to be different in terms of usage, and more people are going to adopt it. It is a very difficult thing to do. That's why it requires a lot of reading and reflecting and kind of like forming a conviction that you still don't have the data to back it up, but you're forming that conviction based on the information you're gathering.
Third one is about product. I call it the better mousetrap, right? So in the world of technology investing, we can't expect to ride a long-term winner on the back of a bad product. And what it means to have a good product or bad product in tech definitely has some nuance. Like, we'll talk about network effects in a moment. The size of the network can determine whether or not a product is worth using or not. And it can overcome some product deficiencies in some cases if there's a larger network around it. But it really does start with whether or not the product that the company offers gives a better overall value proposition than the alternatives out there. And a great example of this is the late 90s during the search engine wars. I don't know if you remember names like AltaVista, Lycos, Ask Jeeves. These were the search engines of the time until Google came out with a much better and more sophisticated algorithm and completely wiped out the competition. Like they, it was a winner take all essentially situation. Simple answer, right? A better product, but a complex innovation behind it. And so, yeah, does the product offer an amazing value proposition that beats the competitors? And some, you know, I think it's great to have a great product, but for massive gains in the stock market, I think if we can find product companies that have the potential to evolve into a platform or ones that already are a platform. And in this context, when I talk about platforms, I'm talking about a foundational set of building blocks that others can innovate on top of it. Think about like the Windows operating system, or where people can aggregate and transact. Meta is a good example of that. NVIDIA, Amazon. So these are all platform companies, and not a surprise that these happen to be the largest companies in the world. So yeah, I definitely think where you can find a platform company or an emerging platform company, I think that can really supercharge your returns. And don't just take my word for it. I read this great book about platforms called The Business of Platforms, where the author analyzed the stock returns of platform companies versus a control sample of non-platform companies. And what they found was that over a 20-year period, the platform companies outperformed the non-platform companies by 6 percentage points each year. And that's on an annualized basis. So it was churning out each year on average 6% alpha relative to these non-platform companies.
If you can find those platform companies that are sort of beaten down due to a few quarters of not good performance, that's that's another one. Like the good example is Meta, when it was significantly down because everybody realized, oh, they're going to just spend so much money on AI and on VR and AR, and it's not going to go anywhere. But the foundation behind it, it could be they have almost the entire population of the internet using people on Earth on this platform, and they have Meta and WhatsApp and a bunch of other platforms, Instagram, so many different businesses. It's almost so many people are building and running our advertising. So it can help you form that conviction that this thing that is beaten down, it can actually recover because it has that product foundation that you were just talking about.
The next criterion is optionality. And this is when a company has a second or third act that keeps the growth going beyond that original idea. And what's necessary for that, of course, is this culture of innovation, right? You got to have leadership set their people up correctly with the right systems to be able to innovate and deliver and build that next invention or that second or third act. And that's really where you see sustained growth, where the next idea can power the next wave of growth. I see two types of optionality. The first one I call use case optionality, and that's where you have this very versatile core technology that's been built, but is adaptable to adjacent markets or adjacent scenarios. A great example, one of the companies in my model portfolio, HubSpot, they started off building this marketing platform, and they were able to add additional modules, or they call them hubs, extending that core tech into a sales hub and then a service hub and then other services beyond that. So that's use case optionality, and that can definitely power multiple rounds of growth if executed well. The second, and I got to admit, the more exciting of the two is something I call mission optionality. This is rare. I think only certain special companies truly have this level of optionality. It's when they've got such a broad, inspiring mission that they're can be multiple paths to realizing that mission. You know, think about Meta, who have this mission of connecting people around the world, or Amazon, where they talk about being the most customer-centric company on Earth, or customer-obsessed, right? So Amazon started with going after that mission by launching a bookstore online. They evolved that into an entire e-commerce site. They would sell any category, any product that you could imagine. And they further extended that broad mission of being customer obsessed by building out this Amazon Web Services business that wasn't even consumer based. It was a complete pivot for them at the time, at least moving into the commercial space, but it was about being customer obsessed to deliver a great infrastructure service for commercial customers. So those are the two types. I think the key to profit from optionality is spotting it early enough. You might be too late when you start to see multiples really expand. That's a clear sign that other investors are catching on. And so I think the edge really comes from being able to uncover companies that have significant and attractive optionality. Not all optionality is attractive. With a high probability of that being realized, that optionality being realized, and there's different forces that go into that. And finally, hopefully something that the market has not fully caught on to or not fully recognized and baked into the stock price. So that's some things to consider when assessing optionality.
Pretty cool. And HubSpot is a company I've never actually used it since you mentioned it. I've never actually looked at it. And it's interesting that you brought it up to me. I always knew them as a marketing platform and never even like got into the detail of it. It sounds like it's something that everybody should look at. So listeners, stock guardians, we're already giving you so many stock ideas. If you've never looked into HubSpot, you've got to take a look at it. And that might be something that I need to look at. I just wanted to bring, because everybody wants the stock ideas. Here, we're giving you a framework and lots of stock ideas too.
Yeah, so for sure.
Let's go for the next two. What are the last two criteria and the framework?
Yeah, number five is companies that have a reasonable valuation and strong fundamentals, right? It starts with finding companies that are small enough from a market cap perspective, that there's enough runway for that market cap to expand and compound over multiple years. I think at an extreme level, right, if you're looking for a 10-bagger, to use our earlier discussion, you probably wouldn't start with an Amazon that is currently valued at $1.7 trillion. Doesn't mean Amazon's not a good investment. In fact, it's one of the companies that is in my model portfolio at the time. I felt the price was quite depressed and saw an opportunity there. But yeah, that's just, you know, you want to keep that in mind when searching for the next multi-bagger. Number two, growth is still king for technology stocks, right? Tech investors know that they're going to pay a premium for that growth, and for that premium to be justified, there needs to be, as a rule of thumb, consistent 20% revenue growth. And you want to see that over a sustained period. Hopefully you can get in early on that sustained run and really benefit from that. But growth is not enough, right? We need to see compelling unit economics that point to a profitable future. There's a number of different ways to measure. We're not going to have the time to get into it. I go into depth in that in my article. It really is about looking at the lifetime value of its customers. And there's some simple measures that you can use as a proxy: gross margin, net retention rate, sales and marketing efficiency. And then finally, valuation matters, right? It always has. I think sometimes people can forget this and get really excited in a name. So of course, when it comes to assessing the value of a technology company, that's a lot of complexity on its own. Like, you kind of got to combine this futuristic vision with financial analysis and embrace that things aren't going to be so certain. And so, you know, traditional metrics like discounted cash flow are less relevant for high growth companies. We got to be comfortable with looking for companies that are ballpark reasonably valued, right? Not the more precise measures that value investors may use, for example. One of the authors who does a lot of tracking and analysis of tech stocks that I really like, Mark Mahaney, he wrote Nothing But Net. He gives a nice rule of thumb from a valuation standpoint to look for companies with a 20% EPS growth outlook. He feels that those can be reasonably be priced at a 20 times PE multiple at the low end to, in some rare cases, 40 PE. But that's if the company is profitable. We know over the course of tech investing that there have been some real winners that over the course of the first 5, 10, and even beyond that, in some cases, what turned out to be amazing investments were not profitable during those initial years, or they were producing net losses. Think about Amazon or Netflix, right? So in these cases, these are companies who made a very conscious decision to not focus on short-term earnings, but they chose to invest in growth. And boy, were the long-term shareholders thankful about that, right? In the case of Amazon, it was building out the infrastructure necessary to scale this emerging Amazon Web Services business. For Netflix, it was about developing new content to gain market share. Just because a tech company isn't profitable doesn't mean it's uninvestable. And in fact, some of the best investments in the history of investing were not in those initial years.
That makes a lot of sense. So do you actually, if there's no earnings, so PE is basically not calculable because the denominator is it's zero, it doesn't exist or it's negative. But do you, what other criteria do you use instead? So would you go into the P&L and kind of look at the costs and stuff that they have in there and try to figure out what are the ones that they can be easily cut back? Or do you use something like free cash flow or some other metric instead of traditional earnings to evaluate the profitability, the, I guess, the inherent profitability that exists in that P&L that we can't just see it immediately.
Yeah, I think those are both good methods. There are a set of questions that I try to use in these cases, inspired again by Mark Mahaney, just to give him another plug in the proper credit. But I think, looking at the P&L to get a sense of the unit economics, are there major investments maybe that are causing them to be currently unprofitable that may subside once scale is achieved? A great example in my mind is Uber, where they were not profitable for a while and produced these ridiculous net losses. A lot of that was in these partner incentive payouts that they rightfully felt were necessary to win over the hard side of the network, which was drivers, right? They needed to make it more financially attractive for them to drive on Uber and not Lyft. And so they structured their incentives accordingly. Not saying that I could predict the future. This is more backwards looking. It turned out that was the right investment. And I think Uber has 75% or 80% share relative to Lyft. So obviously that strategy paid off, and now they can really reduce those partner incentives or driver incentives and invest in a great driver experience instead at a lower cost. And they've become profitable as a result. So that's definitely one thing to look for. Is there potential for long-term improvements? Is the premium revenue growth that we're seeing, is that sustainable? So those are just a few of the questions I would use to assess non-profitable early stage companies.
That makes a lot of sense.
One more left, leadership, right? We want strong and visionary leadership. Maybe the best way to think about this is to give a quick example of exemplary leadership that we would want as investors, as in my opinion, to find in our ideas. And it pertains to one of my favorite all-time holdings, which is Meta. This is a stock that I invested in, started on the day of its IPO 12 years ago. It's in my model portfolio, but at the price when I bought it 2 years ago or so. I've continued to put money into Meta. And I think at the end of the day, it's kind of like a bet on Mark Zuckerberg as the CEO. Think about just 2 years ago, the challenging environment he was facing, like massive competition from TikTok. Apple was changing its privacy rules, which was going to drag its revenue down. So Zuckerberg switched on the wartime leadership, as pundits like to call it. It was the year of the efficiency layoffs, operational tightening. And it was this decisive action that really rejuvenated Meta and led to a significant rebound in the company performance and in the price. And so I think it's that blend that he exhibited of technical leadership, of long-term vision, and a willingness to make tough decisions that are just amazing attributes to look for in leaders in technology companies. And he was able to do all of this, quite frankly, because he was a founder, right? Founder-led companies are given more leeway by investors and by employees to do these quick pivots that non-founder contemporaries would probably struggle with. That's the benefit or the payoff for investing in founder-led companies. In fact, there was a Harvard study that quantified this, and they found that founder-led companies outperformed non-founder-led companies by a factor of 4. So not every company is led by a founder, but that's definitely worth some bonus points in my opinion.
Well, excellent. So a 6-part framework to find multi-baggers, and there's a ChatGPT version of it that people can use, but there's also a portfolio on a stock card and on your own website that people can go and take a look and copy and get ideas from. We're in that part of the show that everybody's waiting, although we've already been telling them and giving everybody clues and ideas, HubSpot, Airbnb, Uber, Meta as great examples. But what is one stock on your radar that you may have just recently bought, or you're actually considering and researching and you think is pretty close to meet your investable criteria aspect framework?
Yeah, for sure. There's one that the most recent stock I purchased, which is still going back a few months, I think 4 or 5 months, is Uber. This is definitely one of my highest conviction companies that I own. I definitely view this as a 5 to 10 year type timeframe. So my comments are less about the short term and more about the long term. But I think it's one of those rare companies. It's got the brand that's become a verb. It's now synonymous with modern urban transportation. But I still think it's early innings in the mobility business. And there's a few trends. Like if we think about the framework that we just discussed and apply it to Uber, it's riding this mobility as a service trend where ownership, private car ownership is on the decline. Those miles traveled are moving to mobility services like Uber. Certainly electrification is a big trend. I think that Uber is playing very well. But the trend that I'm most excited about, and I think isn't talked about as much. I know Uber in their investor day mentioned it to some detail for the first time. I haven't seen it to that level. It's autonomous vehicles, right? They've chosen this strategy to partner rather than to build their own. They sold off their AV tech and they're partnering with companies like Waymo and others to convert more of the miles that are getting driven on the network to autonomous. And I think from a TAM perspective, it's already a massive market, right? I think 2 trillion plus across multimodal transportation, delivery. Its delivery business is fantastic. Not as good as freight, but that goes into the north of $2 trillion TAM. I think autonomous vehicles over time, I mean, this is going to take time to play out. This is not a one-year trend. This is 5-10 years as AV gets better and can handle more use cases. I think that has the potential to step change increase the TAM because they're not going to be paying drivers as much through autonomous. So prices can come down, their margins can go up. And as a result of prices coming down, they become much more accessible to more people who otherwise wouldn't be able to afford it. And the volume is really going to grow as a result. So, you know, there's lots from an optionality perspective to get excited about Uber, not just AV. That's a longer trend to be sure, but their emergent ad business is growing rapidly now. They've got a significant number of advertisers already. But yeah, I think this AV isn't quite fully baked in to the price and it will take some time to play out. So you'll have to be patient, but I think, it's a real tailwind. And then finally, leadership. Since assuming CEO role in 2017, their CEO, Dara Khosrowshahi, he's significantly shifted the company's trajectory. He's turned them profitable for consecutive quarters. That commitment and proof of their confidence in staying profitable, I think, was highlighted last week at their investor day where they announced this big share buyback. So I rest really easy with Dara at the helm as the leader of the company.
And I have to say, actually, there's an episode on our YouTube channel on Uber, and we called it Uber Finally Did It, which is basically reaching profitability, which was their goal. And it's a free cash flow generating company, to your point, and very good leadership and lots of interesting strategy in terms of cutting costs, but also redirecting capital to things that matter, which are very interesting. So yes, 100% agree with you. The only I have to spend more time by myself and study this is that at the time when I did the video, I realized there's a lot of people are talking about Uber because it's getting into profitability. And I told people in the audience that I will want to invest in Uber when nobody is talking about it. But right now, everybody's talking about it. But I could be missing out a significant rally just waiting for the time that people are not talking about Uber. So that could be my fallacy around my investment framework. But definitely a great company to consider. Yeah, yeah. And then where can people find you? Where on Twitter, x.com, on your own website? Tell us where we can connect with you and chat with you. Or if people want to send that stock evaluation request, where do they send it?
I would love it if they sent it to me on Twitter or now X. So my handle is @OwlWealthy. And I tweet a lot, I would say. So I love engaging there. That would definitely be the way to reach me and get my latest and most current thoughts. Otherwise, I do have my website, thewealthyowl.com, where I post my portfolio. I've got my deep dives and my more well-developed, well-researched ideas probably are on the site.
That's excellent. Well, great. And we make sure we put links to all that good ways of connecting with you in the show notes and in the newsletter that goes on Saturdays to all of our users. Great. And well, thank you for being on the show and sharing your portfolio on Stock Card. We're sharing your framework with us today. And I can't wait to have you back in a couple of months or a year or so and see how this market-beating portfolio of yours is performing. I'm sure it's going to be much better than S&P because it's built based on really good framework and good thought process. Well, so I appreciate it. Thank you very much, Matt, for being on the show.
Thank you. I had a lot of fun. This was great.